Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
One of the things we do a lot of in this podcast is identify a question, a problem, and then present the arguments for or against that idea. Our goal is in part to change the point of view of our listeners, or to equip them to change the points of view of other people. But sometimes those arguments can actually cloud the issue. We certainly learned that lesson the hard way when we dove in headfirst half a year ago into the topic of intelligent design, the bacterial flagellum, and the long-term evolution experiments, and we completely lost half of our audience in the minute specific details and facts. While preparing for an interview we'll release in a couple weeks, I came across this great quote from a Jewish rabbi and doctor of philosophy, Dr. Rabbi Bradley Shavit Artson, who wrote, "Thinking that the only kinds of truths are facts will lead you to miss out on Shakespeare and preschool, romance and goodness, grandchildren and community, and a whole lot of relationships and emotions that can lift us beyond ourselves. Facts are just the structure in which the truth of meaning and significance can express itself, like a dream catcher." Those are penetrating words for a scientist like myself. A few days ago, I was listening to the historian, filmmaker Ken Burns give a commencement speech to students at Brandeis University, and in it, he offered up another great quote, which makes the same point. This quote coming from a novel by Richard Powers with the title Overstory, and which won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. Powers wrote, "The best arguments in the world won't change a single person's point of view. The only thing that can do that is a good story." That's another thing we do often on this podcast. We will often ask our guests to tell their story because we think we can learn a lot from each other. And sometimes knowing their story helps inform us why they hold the views that they do. Today we're going to put a spotlight on young earth creationism. We've done many episodes on this topic before, telling the history behind that movement, how its proponents get that idea from the Bible and or from church tradition, and the strategies they use to convince others of that idea. But we've also heard the stories from many people who have struggled through that idea, often losing their faith in the process. Paul Enns, the YouTube blogger who otherwise goes by the name Paulogia, is one that comes to mind, but there's many others. Sarah Hen Hayward, David McMillan, Doug Traversa, a long list, including my own story in the very first three episodes of this podcast. We'll put links in the show notes to all those people and a few more. This week and next, we're going to add two more names to that long list, both of them because they not only struggle personally with the idea of young earth creationism, but also they're at the front line in the struggle publicly against young earth creationism. Both of them teach at the secondary and post-secondary levels of academia. Today, we'll talk to Dr. Joel Anderson, and next week to Dr. Joel Duff about young earth creationism. Not so long ago, someone close to me asked, "Why are you still talking about this? You've moved on." But the problem is, many others have not moved on. I mean, the polling agency Pew Research will regularly take the pulse on society, American society, when it comes to their values and beliefs. And for decades, they've found that a substantial number of adults, roughly a third of them, believe that humans have always existed in their present form from the beginning of time, or that humans coexisted with the dinosaurs. That comes straight out of young earth creationism. Many of our listeners are still stuck in that world. They may have just started their journey out of that world, a journey that I started 30 years ago. They'll have family and friends who are young earth creationists. They may be going to a church that's quite young earth creationist. And so they are still wrestling with it.
Yes, it's interesting that when you personally have moved on any particular issue in your life, when you've kind of explored it and engaged with people and so on, and then you've come to some sort of settlement with the issue, you could kind of feel like that everybody else has also moved on, right? But just like what you're saying, it's still a very powerful force in our culture. I know in my own context that I know many people who would still be young earth creationists. And so I have to be prepared to, you know, engage with them and so on.
But the fact that that person asked me that question, it did have me wondering, okay, am I just letting my own feelings influence whether there was really a need to do this? So I checked with the private Facebook discussion group. That group is roughly a couple hundred of our more dedicated listeners who give us ideas and feedback for the podcast. And by the way, if you're a listener and you want to be part of that discussion, just go to the groups tab in Facebook and search for our name and logo. But I asked that group if they thought there was still room for discussion on this topic of young earth creationism. And over half, gave me the thumbs up. 58% said yes or definitely yes. A quarter of them didn't say no, but did wonder if there was anything new to be said there. And a sixth of them, 17%, said, no, please not again.
Yeah. But no, but I think, you know, those numbers kind of demonstrate that it's still a live issue for a good number of people. Yeah.
So the opportunity to do this topic came a short while ago when someone brought to our attention a new book that's being written for Wipfenstock. I was given the opportunity to read an early draft, and I thought, after reading it, we needed to get this guy onto the podcast, not only for the content of the book itself, but also because of his personal story. And you're going to hear both of those because we have that author here in the studio right now. Joel Anderson, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you very much.
Yes, welcome.
Joel, you came to my attention through one of our podcast listeners, a mutual friend, Dr. Dustin Burlett. It was through him that I found out you were in the final stages of a book with the title, The Heresy of Ham. I've got to say, that title alone was certainly very attention-grabbing. I didn't immediately get the connection to Ken Ham. So for a few seconds, I was wondering, what's your problem with bacon?
Yeah, I hate pig.
And even the subtitle got my attention as one of the hosts for this podcast, because the subtitle is, What Every Evangelical Needs to Know About the Creation-Evolution Controversy and What We Can All Learn About Rigid Ideology and Fighting the Culture War. That's quite a title.
Yeah.
I like the heresy of Ham because, you know, be it a literature major, I like the alliteration.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, heresy is kind of a, you know, a big word. So the first thing I, early on in the book, I make sure this is what I mean by it. You know.
We'll talk later in the episode about the book itself. But first, I think we need to give the audience a better idea of who you are and your story. And I wanted this to be an important part of the episode because your story is exactly what this podcast is all about. You portray or you personify our target audience, people who have been wounded by the evangelical movement and are revising their worldview, their spirituality because of that. And because you were one of the educators in the evangelical school system, you taught their high schoolers and college kids. So let's start first with your life before high school, before you really start to develop your own worldview. Let's talk about the influences of your parents, your home church, your peer group on your personal beliefs at that time.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Wheaton, Illinois, you know, where Wheaton College is. That's where my parents met there in college, and we just ended up settling there. Yeah, it was in the 70s and 80s. I grew up in your typical Wheaton-ish evangelical world, went to an Assemblies of God church. And overall, you know, my upbringing was very good. My parents are very sensible people. You would never guess they went to the Assemblies of God church because, you know, charismatics. But they were very, my dad's Swedish, so he's very low-key. Let's put it that way. So yeah, growing up, it was a very stable family life, good neighborhood. I went to public schools up through eighth grade. I went to a Christian school through high school, which was good. I still have some lifelong friends from there. Overall, growing up was fine, you know. And even the Assemblies of God church that we grew up in, like some Assemblies of God charismatic churches can tend to be a little zany. but this was it was a good, decent church. So I grew up in a good church, good Christian high school, good family. When it was after my junior year in high school, I kind of realized, hey, I never thought out my faith. What do I believe? And if you want to say I had a crisis of faith for a high school kid, that summer between junior and senior year, I kind of didn't tell anybody, but like, I'm an agnostic. I don't know what I believe. And I read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, which to me is one of the most influential books for me. It showed that you can be an intellectual, thoughtful person and still be a Christian. That and my sister got me into Sting, you know, the singer, songwriter, Police. And he had just come out with his first solo album, The Dream of the Blue Turtles. And it sounds weird, but that spiritually, that was an amazingly influential album for me. C.S. Lewis and Sting. And then his first three solo albums was just amazing. So, you know, I started thinking through my faith that way, you know, listening to the Anglican C.S. Lewis. And then in college, I started reading the works of Thomas Merton, the Catholic monk. who was also very influential. And then I just kind of, you know, I'm still in the evangelical world, but the stuff that was feeding me was more either Anglican or Catholic, or then later Orthodox, you know, more liturgical, ancient faith really appealed to me.
What were you looking for when you were reading all those diverse subjects and writers?
Well, I think it was just, you know, trying to make sense of your life and what impact Christianity has on me and the world, and, you know, just basic questions of truth, you know, worldview. How do you view things? How does this affect how you view everything? And it was just very spiritually insightful. And those were the things that really appealed to me. And so that, you know, through college.
If I could interrupt you there, though, Joel. So I also grew up in a Pentecostal Assemblies background. And if I was carrying around books from a Catholic monk, there would have been comments, there would have been resistance.
Yeah.
Did you not have people asking questions?
Well, to be honest, like when I was in, it was Thomas Merton was once I went to college, right? And so like when I was in Wheaton, carrying around C.S. Lewis is still totally acceptable. I mean, Wheaton College has the C.S. Lewis Center, so that's okay.
Right. When
I was in college, I went to Northwest Missouri State University and was involved in a Christian group there called the Christian Campus House. And again, this is how I will always say, looking back, I was so naive most of my life about, you know, when you are an Assemblies of God, when you grew up in the Assemblies of God church, you don't know anything about other denominations. You just think we're all Christians, right?
Right. Yeah.
Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah.
Part of why I asked the question and I gave you the background that I did is because we believe that basically Catholics were going to hell, right? They're not us. Even Baptists were suspects.
Yeah.
You know, we still thought, okay, yeah, they're Christian, but they're not Christian enough yet. But certainly Catholics were just not one of us. That's why I was surprised.
Well, that's the thing. I think like the church I grew up, it was kind of a bigger church. And I think that vibe, I never got that vibe in that church. My parents were always very thoughtful and insightful, you know. So I just never got that from anybody really. And so I just, when I happened to come across Thomas Merton, I just thought, this is really good and insightful. So then after college, trying to get a full-time job as a teacher, but you have no experience. So you sub for 2 years and you hate your life. I joined the Peace Corps and I lived for a year in Kazakhstan. I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And it was like this epiphany. Like I want to go to graduate school and study biblical studies. Even if I don't do anything with it, I need to know this better. And so after the Peace Corps, I looked around. That's where I ended up going to Regent College in Vancouver. And there, it's very Anglican-y, you know, a lot of Anglican influence. And you were a little bit more open to explore more stuff. Those 2 years at Regent College were huge for me, you know, spiritually. But even then, I focused on the New Testament. I wasn't asking questions about Genesis or anything yet. But I remember taking what course was it? Biblical theology course with Gordon Fee. And he went through Revelation and he pointed out how at the end of Revelation, when John goes, has a vision of the heavenly Jerusalem, and he goes in and it's the tree of life and it's the river of life. And he pointed out all these theological literary connections between Genesis 1 through 11 and Revelation, because it brings everything to an end. I thought, that is so cool, being the literary background. And so that just fascinated me. After Regent College, I then got a job teaching. This is my first full-time teaching job at a small evangelical school in California, in the Bay Area. And I taught there for 4 years. And because they didn't have much of a Bible program and I had a master's degree, they kind of gave me it and said, hey, you can teach what you want. I'm like, great. And I wanted to do a course on Revelation because, you know, that's not controversial. but I didn't think of it that way. I thought it's just fascinating because I didn't grow up with Left Behind series. I grew up with Thief in the Night. You remember those movies? The Hal Lindsey stuff.
I knew enough.
That was ridiculous. And I thought most kids are scared of Revelation. And I had studied it. And I'm like, I understand how to first century context. And that'd be fascinating to do. And one of the things I thought would really be interesting, because Gordon Fee opened my eyes to it, is like before we got into Revelation, take like the first 4 weeks to take them through Genesis 1 through 11, right? So they could see the bookends, I guess. And at that time, this was like 1998. Again, I didn't know anything about, I never cared about evolution, creation, evolution debate yet. I was just doing biblical studies, trying to understand the text. And I came to the conclusion, Genesis 1 through 11 is clearly presented not as history, as in, once you get to Genesis 12 and Abraham, it's presented as history. You can argue how much of it is, you know, fictionalized, but it is presented as history. Genesis 1 through 11, it isn't.
Right.
It's just not. There's parallels to other ancient Near Eastern myths, and if you understand what that means, it's setting the theological basis to understand history, but it's not history itself. I think in the book, I kind of liken it to, like, if you're watching a play, Genesis 1 through 11 is like the stage in the background. And the play is the human history that goes across the play, so you can interpret it against that background. So, for example, when you have the Exodus, when the Hebrews pass through the Red Sea, it's described with creation language because he's creating a people. So he uses, yeah. And so I just kind of, that's what you do. And so I just naively taught that to these high school kids, these Christian high school kids, and a few kids kind of freaked out because they hadn't heard that, a couple of them, but most of them, and this was a big eye-opening thing for me that's kind of guided my whole career in education, is like, there was like two or three kids in particular who, when I went through this stuff the first time, they were like, no, I don't respect you as a teacher. You know, they were really angry.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get fired. But then the period would end and everybody else, the silent majority of kids who are just learning, they would come up to me and like, I am so glad we're doing this. I never understood this. This makes so much sense now. I understand. And so I'm like, I'm still going to teach this the way I, because it's the majority of kids want to learn. You're always going to have a few loud mouths who don't, you kind of freak out. But long story short, I ended up teaching that course like 3 years. It was one of the kids' favorites. One of the best compliments I ever got with Revelation is kids would be done with it and like, you know what? It doesn't scare me anymore. I actually understand it, you know? And so I think that's what education is. So
again, what grade level was this again?
Kind of like juniors and seniors.
Okay.
Yeah, like 17, 16, 17. And so after that, I went to Trinity Western to get a master's in Old Testament. And after that, I ended up here in Arkansas at another Christian school where I taught for 4 years. And they already had a worldview curriculum. And one of the things they did, I taught senior worldview for a couple of years, what was kind of Western culture, and then junior worldview, where they did a variety of things. And one of the things they did, they had a unit on Genesis 1 through 11. Like, oh, wow, that's cool. But the curriculum that they had for it was kind of lame. And so I suggested to the other worldview teachers, I taught this at my old school. Why don't you take a look at the stuff, and they all liked it. And so we will go through this. It ran afoul with the whole administration was in the midst of a turnover, and one of the guys didn't like it. Long story short, they didn't want me there anymore, but it was all very ambiguous. I was never got any straight answers. It was very frustrating. By the way, when I came to Little Rock the first time in 2003, I noticed there was a Greek Orthodox church there, and I had been reading Greek Orthodox authors and I loved it. I went to the Greek Orthodox liturgy and I'm like, this is home. And so I did not think it was a big deal. I joined the Orthodox church. It was Christian. And I think that was one of the things at the school in Little Rock, that freaked them out as well, but they never said it. But fortunately, the principal who originally hired me there, he had moved on to a school in Alabama. Okay. And so when I wasn't welcome back at this school in Little Rock, this other guy, he hired me for his school. He liked my stuff and he knew I kind of got screwed over. And I ended up being there for 8 years. The first 5 or 6 years were great because the guy who hired me, he was there and he gave me the worldview program. There wasn't a program. And so I developed a freshman curriculum, a sophomore curriculum, junior curriculum, senior curriculum. One was Old Testament, New Testament, church history, theology, and then Western culture worldview. And in that senior year, that's where I developed a unit on Darwin. Okay. And again, I thought this is just, it's worth knowing. They have to know how to refute it. That's what I did going into it.
Right.
But the more I learned it, some of it made sense. And so what I ended up doing when I had the Darwin unit, because I didn't want to push any view, I wanted the students just to get an idea of it. I would lay out all the general views concerning the creation evolution debate. I'd have like the Ken Ham young earth creationist. Then I called like the atheistic evolutionary guys like Richard Dawkins, and then the theistic evolutionists, because that was when BioLogos was starting their thing. You know, and I just kind of laid out the views, had them analyze, what do you think are the strengths and weaknesses? Something to think about. That's all I was doing. And it went fine. It was really good. But then the guy who hired me, he once again moved on to another school, and they brought in another headmaster. I did not know this, but this other headmaster in my book, I call him Mr. Spencer. That's not his name. He really was a hardcore young earth creationist. And in 2014, when Bill Nye and Ken Ham had their big debate, I watched it, and I did a number of blog posts on my blog just analyzing the debate. And I was honestly shocked at how bad Ken Ham was in the debate. He wouldn't answer anything. And so I just did this critique of the debate. That was in February of 2014. And then by June, Mr. Spencer called me to Panera Bread. He had concerns about me teaching there. I'd already signed my contract, so he had to have me for one more year. But I just could not understand why he had such a problem with this. I wasn't pushing evolution. I was just, Ken Ham does not give good answers. But I couldn't even question that. And I kind of go in the personal story in my book about that last year there. After that, I ended up fortunately getting an adjunct position at the University of North Alabama. And I did that for the last 8 years. And then I moved here.
So again, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on was to tell your story, and not just the story of you growing up and going through your various questions, that sort of thing, but also your experience in Alabama, where you were the teacher.
Yeah. So now when I was in Alabama, there was no Orthodox church. And so I went to a Baptist church for a while. I went to a Methodist church for a while. But most of the people at that school didn't even know I was Orthodox because I wasn't pushing it. You know, I was just, you just make do. So basically the second to last year at that school, and again, I had taught this Darwin unit for years and it was fine. One of the local pastors came in, so he wanted to talk to me, and he was concerned about what I was teaching. And he started off by mentioning that at one point in one of my classes, we were doing the book of Jonah, and I had done the master's thesis on Jonah, and I'm convinced that there was a historical Jonah, but the story itself, I think, was meant to be a post-exilic parable. But again, high school level, I'm not going to go into my master's thesis. So some kids were asking about it. I said, well, you know, some people think it's history. Some people think it's kind of a parable. I lean toward it being a parable, but wasn't part of the class. It was just kind of a side discussion. So this pastor came in and he was, did you tell my son that Jonah was a parable? I was like, well, I think in a conversation I mentioned that some people thought it was. It's like, well, when you told my son Jonah was a parable, you were telling him I was a liar. And I was like, no, I don't think I told him you're a liar. You know, and then he just started questioning me and asking, well, what do you think about Genesis 1 through, you know, all this stuff, and got kind of heated for sure. And I got really rattled by it because he was kind of a big pastor in town. And so I went to the new headmaster that night at the football game because I wanted to be open, clear the air. Went to him. I said, you know, Pastor Clark came to me, it kind of rattled me. And it's like, to be honest with you, when he was asking about creation evolution thing, you know, I'm not a young earth creationist, but it's not a big issue for me. And Mr. Spencer, the new headmaster, said, well, I am a young earth creationist, but if the board doesn't agree with me, I'll back off. I was like, what the heck does that mean? It kind of freaked me out. And that was the around the fall of that year. But the rest of the year, nothing seemed to happen. That's when the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate happened. So I thought, I guess it blew over. No big deal. But then that following June is when Mr. Spencer called me to Panera Bread And he started questioning me about that again and how he really had concerns. Because in my blog post on the debate, I mentioned Irenaeus, the early church father. And I mentioned, you know, I'm Orthodox and I really think learning about the early church fathers is an important guide to how you understand some passages and stuff. And he's like, ah, the fact that you're Orthodox, that's really concerning to me. It was basically my Orthodoxy and my view on Genesis 1 through 11 really was concerning to him because it sounded too liberal. And I'm not liberal. I think I'm all over the map on a lot of things, but one thing I'm definitely not is ultra liberal. And if you know anything about church history, the Eastern Orthodox Church is probably the most conservative of everything. And they don't deviate from the councils. That's as conservative as you get. So he basically was concerned whether or not I was a good fit for the worldview program. And I remember thinking, you mean the one that I built?
Yeah.
But basically, it was pretty clear that when it all came down to it, the fact that I did not agree with Ken Ham, he didn't want me at the school. And he made it clear that the board was on his side, but I still had a year left on my contract and I wasn't going to leave. And I think he was hoping I was just quit. It was pretty clear he was trying to do everything he can to irritate me to where I would just quit. Very, very underhanded, petty things. And then he, throughout that summer, he would send me emails about how I was wrong, saying stuff like, I spoke with the voice of the serpent and I was a wolf in sheep's clothing. And no matter what I would try to explain to him, and I was trying to be very conciliatory, like one of the first things he wanted to know, Orthodoxy concerned him. And he wanted to know my view on Orthodoxy. So I kept, the big thing I emphasized was the thing I liked about Orthodoxy more than anything else was that it focused on the real fundamentals of the faith that all Christians share. So like most churches, they have their basic statement of faith. It comes from the Nicene Creed. That's what Orthodoxy focuses on. And he took that to mean like, you're pushing Orthodoxy on the school. That's not what we believe as evangelicals. So I'm like, yeah, if you believe in the Trinity, yeah, I think it is what you believe. I mean, but no matter what I said, he had already determined because I didn't agree with Ken Ham, and because Ken Ham, and this is one of the things I say in the book, the main focus, the main drive of Ken Ham's view of creationism isn't so much to understand science better or even understand Genesis 1 through 11 better, it's to fight the culture war, you know, fight the secular liberals. And I think tying Genesis to that is really problematic because I believe Genesis 1 through 11 is a myth, but I'm not a cultural liberal. But in his mind, I must be.
Would you say that he was opposing you, and I mean this in a polite sense of the word, the literal sense of the word, was he opposing you literally out of ignorance, meaning not knowing? He hadn't read about Orthodoxy, had not read about other interpretations of Genesis 1 to 11. He just didn't know.
Yeah.
So was it, in the politest sense of the word, ignorance, or was it just a dogmatic, if it's not Ken Ham, then you're wrong? And he didn't do any homework. He just said, well, it's not what Ken Ham says, so it's not for me.
I think it's kind of both. I think that kind of view is ignorance. You know, that is all he read. He didn't know anything about Orthodoxy. He didn't know anything about church history. All he knew is that Dr. Anderson doesn't believe the earth is 6,000 years old and doesn't believe Adam and Eve were two literal people. He must be a liberal who's trying to push gayness and abortion on people. That was his mindset. I couldn't understand it. I'm like, why are you making the connection between Genesis 1 through 11 and some modern culture issue? I just didn't, nothing made sense. And so basically for the rest of the year, I just kept my mouth shut. And it was a very tough year. So I was not in a good place. But the other thing he decided to do that final year was he made the push not only to get rid of me, but to really push young earth creationism on the school. Now, again, it's a small evangelical school in the South. I'm guessing most people, teachers and parents and kids there, they would not say they believe evolution, but it was not a major thing of their life. Just like me growing up, I would have said that, but I didn't matter. But then he decided that last year for our once a week morning faculty meeting, Bible study kind of book club, I don't know what you call it. We'd get together once a week to pray and read a book. He wanted us to read Ken Ham's Already Gone for like our devotional reading. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be fun.
And I don't know that book. I'm sure some listeners don't. So in a sentence or two, what is this book about?
Basically, it's the same thing as every other of his books. It's basically Western culture in America is going to hell in a handbasket. And it's all because the church has compromised and accepted millions of years. Because once you accept millions of years, you let gay marriage and abortion run rampant, that kind of culture war mentality.
Yeah.
And so the first, I had read it over the summer and I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see what my fellow teachers think of this. But I was not going to say anything in these meetings. I just sat quiet, zipped my mouth. And we started having these weekly meetings. And the first three or four chapters was pretty much your standard. If you grew up in evangelicalism, pretty much your standard. There's things wrong with our culture. We need to get back to the Bible. You know, we need to rely, you know, standard things that most Christians go, oh, yeah, great. But I knew it was coming in chapter four when he starts really hammering the Genesis 1 through 11 stuff hard is the root of all evil. Once we got to chapter 4 and then chapter 5, the teacher stopped commenting because he could just tell. They're like, did he just mention dinosaurs? What is this? You know, and then finally, at the end of one of the meetings, like the librarian, who's kind of a spark plug, she kind of raised her hands like, okay, why is he obsessed with Genesis 1 through 11? There's more to the Bible than Genesis 1 through 11. And then at that point, all the teachers started voicing, like, they did not like the book. And so we dismissed. And then the very next day, he called a special faculty meeting and he made this speech like, you know, we're a young earth creationist school and we got to stand on God's word. And we got a dead silence. Now, again, I can guarantee you most of those teachers would not say they believed in evolution, but they knew there was something wrong with the way Ken Ham was presenting this. After that was like halfway through the year. And by the end of the year, he announced that he was going to, they're pushing a curriculum from Bob Jones University that they're going to start in junior high. And it was standard young earth creationist stuff. And the fact, are you familiar with Bob Jones University?
Oh, yeah.
We've talked about them, yes.
Yeah. And that didn't go over well. But again, in his mind, it's like, well, but it's young earth creationism. That's good. And because he's focused solely on that, he kind of turns a blind eye to other things that aren't so good, you know?
Right.
And so I left at the end of the year. And at that point, I thought my career in teaching Christian schools was done. And I want to make clear that back when I was at Regent College, when I first started learning biblical studies, I didn't have a desire to be a college professor. I wanted to teach in Christian high schools and to teach what I was learning in Christian schools. And then this guy effectively ended my career doing that.
And this is why I wanted our listeners to hear your story, because not only are you telling your own personal interaction with young earth creationism and trying to understand what you believe for yourself, but now also you're speaking from the inside as an educator in that world, in the evangelical world, and the experiences that you had with the people who control the curriculum, who control the teaching of these kids. And you're not alone in that kind of a story. I mean, we all know of Peter Enns at the university level. Yep. He lost his job because he started to say, you know what, I'm starting to see the Bible a little bit differently. I've written down some names that I got from your book. Some of these names I don't recognize, but Bruce Waltke, yeah. Carl Giberson, John Schneider, they all lost their jobs. And I think they're all at the university level. They lost their jobs because they were brave enough to ask questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was back in the mid 2000s and into the 20 teens. That's when like BioLogos started and kind of pushing this issue to the forefront. Cause I think a lot of Christians never bothered with it because evolution was always just seen as atheism, right? And again, a lot of times people like, for example, Richard Dawkins, that's what they do. They do equate it. And so a lot of people think it's the same. That's a problem. And then, especially within evangelicalism, the doctrine of inerrancy. Too often, inerrancy tends to make it mean people assume, therefore, Genesis 1 through 11 must be literal and historical. So I think in the early mid-2000s, I think all those questions started, for whatever reason, started bubbling up. And The good thing is, I think in the last 15 years, I think a lot of progress has been made. I think a lot more evangelical Christians are at least more open to the idea, and they realize that evolution is not the same as atheism. Still, there is this tendency to, like, somehow we have to make Genesis 1 through 11 fit scientifically somehow, possibly. And again, being the literary guy that when I first studied Genesis 1 through 11 back in the 90s, before I got into this any science stuff, I was like, you don't need to make Genesis 1 through 11 fit into any scientific or historical category if the original author was not writing it that way. Like, I mean, I use the word myth, and that freaks people out, but I really make sure I explain it in the book what I mean by that. Doesn't mean it's not true. It's a specific genre of literature.
Yeah.
And if it is that genre of literature, you don't have to make it fit somehow else. It's truthful the way it is.
Right.
And so therefore, yeah.
So Joel, we've heard your story. Let's talk a little bit about the book, just the purpose of this book. I understand you wrote it as part of an introspective journey. You were trying to figure out what just happened to me in the past year or 10 years. What just happened? And I know what that's like. I've been there. I've done the same thing. But that means I also know that that's the first version of the book. Then you go back and you finesse it for a target audience. Mm-hmm. And so now it takes on a different purpose. It's no longer about you trying to figure it out for yourself, but now you're trying to tell a story. And what is the target audience for your book? What's the purpose for your book?
Well, the target audience is pretty much the evangelical world. And I'm thinking America, evangelicalism, and Canada too, because I assume that most people in evangelicalism, you know, probably had similar rearings as I did. You know, you grew up in evangelicalism, you think evolution equals atheism. And especially now with Ken Ham being so influential, and I experienced firsthand at how toxic that is and how deceptive a lot of that is. And I was always concerned with my students, because I've had a number of students in my career. They grow up going to Christian home, Christian school, and then they go to college, take a basic biology course or a basic geology course. And because they've been told, not by me, but they've been told that, you know, Genesis 1 through 11 is has to be historical. And if it's not, then how do you know the resurrection didn't happen? You know, it's all or nothing. And then they find out basic scientific facts about the age of the earth. And a lot of them go, oh, I guess I can't be a Christian anymore because I was told. And when you tell somebody that, and then they find out the truth of a little, they're going to take you up on it. And I had a lot of former students who are no longer Christians. And it kind of started on that issue. And in the last 8 years since the original book came out, I've met a lot of ex-evangelicals who are very, I would say, stridently, almost atheistically militant against everything evangelical now. And they always say it always has roots in this issue about Genesis 1 through 11. And that is so sad to me. I mean, I was lucky that I ended up researching Genesis 1 through 11, how to read it from a literary perspective, long before I cared about the creation evolution debate. I already knew it wasn't tied to that. And so therefore, it didn't freak me out when I learned more about evolution. But a lot of evangelicals, especially in these last 20 years, who have been influenced by young earth creationism and Ken Ham, those two things are so linked that it shatters their faith if Genesis 1 through 11 isn't literally scientifically true. And on top of that, and this, like, the subtitle of the new book is about the culture war, the fact that Ken Ham ties it so much to the culture war, the focus really isn't about trying to understand the Bible better or even trying to understand science. It's always, let's use these things to fight the culture war. And that's a problem, because I think when you do that, I purposely did not touch upon it too much in the book, because it, how can I put this? Ever since 2016, the presidential politics have been really poisonous across the board on both sides. And I didn't want to get into that, but a lot of, you could say, more right-wing fundamentalist types have gotten so wrapped up in one party as if that's God's party, then I would say far left progressive ex-evangelical types pretty much are convinced that the other part, and it's just, they're taking their Christianity, and I would say jettisoning biblical Christianity, and just putting a Jesus label on their political beliefs.
Yeah.
And they're fighting that culture war in a very nasty way. Ken Ham does it that way, but then a lot of people who have been hurt by Ken Ham end up doing the same thing from the other side. And like when I got hurt by the Ken Ham stuff, I didn't lose my faith. And I'm like, why didn't I? It's because I had an understanding of Genesis 1 through 11 to begin with. It wasn't tied to the things that were tied to that. And I wanted to write a book to kind of reassure your typical conservative evangelical that you can look at this issue, even if you don't buy into every evolutionary claim. Again, I'm not a PhD scientist. I don't know all that. I know enough to know that, yeah, the Earth is probably a little over 6,000 years old, probably billions of years old. And I'm a biblical scholar enough to know how to interpret Genesis 1 through 11. The evolutionary scientific question does not affect, it shouldn't affect your reading of Genesis 1 through 11. You can understand that all on its own. And so I wanted to kind of open up a little space where people can go, oh, okay, that's how you do biblical exegesis. That's how you understand the Bible more. And a little bit of church history, because, you know, being Orthodox, you know, I think evangelicals could learn a little bit about church history more. And that's the other thing that I was very thankful for is learning about Irenaeus and his view of Adam and Eve. I was like, oh, this really early church father, his view of Adam and Eve, that tells me that the Ken Ham view really doesn't go back that far.
Yeah.
I want to stick back with the early church fathers. I think they had a better handle on scripture than Ken Ham. And so, again, a lot of it is because there's so much toxicity around this issue and it's so controversial, even though I call it the heresy of Ham, which is very kind of provocative, I think most of the book is meant to be reassuring. Like, this is how you understand Genesis 1 through 11. This is, look at what Ken Ham says here. He's like calling everybody who disagrees with him like as compromised. Really? You know, it's divisive. Yeah.
I like the double entendre of the title. I don't know if you meant this or not, but, you know, you also have another horrible abuse of the Bible, unfortunately, in American, but not just American history, really in world history, on the issue of slavery. And of course, the idea of the curse of Ham, that was heavily used in the South, you know, to justify mm-hmm. slavery.
Scott is getting at here is a story in which Noah puts a curse on one of his three sons, his son named Ham, for truly bizarre reasons. You'll have to read it for yourself in Genesis chapter 9. And then many, many centuries later, theologians identified that son Ham as an ancient ancestor of people living in Africa. And so, by that logic, black people were now living under Noah's curse on Ham.
So it demonstrates how our understanding of these texts they have real world implications. It's not just theoretical. They affect the way people behave, the way people view other people, they affect mm-hmm. politics. And I really like the fact of how you've shown that linkage, because for me, that's the crux of the issue, that fundamentalists and later evangelicals see the link between evolution equals a godless view of the universe, and it equals materialism, and that leads to everything else, right? Like you said. So it's great the work you're doing to cut that tie and to say, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that at all. And that exists on, in fairness to the fundamentalists and the evangelicals, in fairness to them, the secular world has equated the two quite a bit, right? People like Richard Dawkins, even Bill Nye, Hitchens, Neil deGrasse Tyson, a lot of these guys. So they do link it, you know, they need to do the same thing. Stop doing that. You know, you're scientists. Stop trying to be culture warriors. In fact, Neil deGrasse Tyson's interesting. He's gotten himself into a real uncomfortable position because he tries to take, he's been questioned on gender issues. And boy, does he ever try to sidestep that, because now as a scientist, right? and all of a sudden you realize, so we need to, you know, we need to have a better discussion that these are two separate things. Science is one thing, and philosophy and culture and social, that's another thing, you know, and There's linkage between, I'm not saying there's not a linkage between them, but it's not the kind of direct linkage that the Ken Hams or the Richard Dawkins of the world would like us to think, in my opinion. Yeah.
Even in my research on it, I read up more on the Scopes Monkey Trial of the 1920s. That blew my mind because I was always taught, a certain narrative about that, that all these young Earth creationists were against evolution. And then you're like, William Jennings Bryan was not a young Earth creationist.
No.
He didn't even understand what the actual theory was. He was concerned with, rightly, I would say, eugenics and using science and evolution as an excuse to get rid of the undesirable. Much of what he said about that was like, that's actually pretty insightful. It's just biological theory of evolution still is something different. It's philosophical materialism and the biological theory of evolution are not the same thing. And you have to see that. And again, I say in the book, even if you don't completely buy into every evolutionary claim, that's fine. Your salvation doesn't depend on it. We all probably have certain views on certain things scientifically or socially that at some point we're going to realize, hey, we were wrong on that. Who knows? Maybe some scientific discovery will happen and oh, the Earth is only 7 billion years old. We thought, or maybe it's 20 billion. Okay. It
Right.
doesn't affect how you read Genesis 1 through 11.
No.
Joel, one other question I wanted to get from you. From your perspective, having gone through this experience, what advice can you give to us about how to respond to young Earth creationism? I'm getting at the idea that many of our listeners will have family or friends who are young Earth creationists. They'll have colleagues. They might work for a young Earth creationist. So they encounter young Earth creationism all around them. How should we respond to them?
Well, I think the best way is not to be combative. Because if you are so combative about it, you're kind of like giving the impression, like, yes, evolution is an important issue for your faith. It's like, no, it's not. Like growing up, my parents, if I ever did ask them about that, it was more like, well, however long God created, how long God took, ultimately the point of Genesis 1 through 11 is that God created and that human beings are made in his image. That's the important part. How long it took, kind of irrelevant to that point. And so focus on what the theological points in Genesis 1 through 11 are that people will agree on. There is one God, he is the creator, that human beings are made in his image. And this creation, no matter how crazy it gets, is still good and orderly, and that he's going to redeem it. That's the message. And if you understand that, then you get into Abraham. That's when he enters into history. He's going to redeem it through this guy and his family, and it gets fulfillment in Christ. And again, over the last 8 years, because when I first wrote the book, I got kind of involved in a number of like Facebook creation evolution groups. I've had a lot of debates. You get some young Earth creationists who are just, no matter what you say, they're just looking for a fight. I've ended up being provoked. I probably said some nasty things here and there. And it's okay to get into a little back and forth. You can get heated at times. I've always made it a point not to get nasty and personal. Like some people, when they call Ken Ham, they have like, oh, the hamster. He's still a human being. I'm not gonna, I poke fun at his views, but I'm sure he's a very good, loving father and grandfather. He's not the devil,
Right.
So basically, you're saying don't be adversarial, don't get emotional, and be
maybe get
graceful.
emotional a little bit. And when you do slip up, mental note, I won't go there.
Joel, it was just last week we were talking to Dr. Mark Knoll, the author of the book, Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. I'm hearing a lot of elements that resonate with Dr. Knoll. One of the things that we talked about was the prognosis for the future. Do things look good? Is he optimistic or pessimistic? And generally, he was very optimistic that things have been improving. And again, he's referring from having written the book 30 years ago, he saw that things are starting to look good. How would you answer that question? What's the prognosis for the future on this?
Well, I think there's always going to be, everything's always going to get better. The whole idea that we're all always progressing better. I think for a lot of people, they are getting to a better understanding of things like church history and biblical theology and science. They're getting a better handle on it. I mean, just the last 15 years in bio, since BioLogos came out, it's the creation evolution issue is a lot more open for discussion, and that's good. At the same time, well, that's good, and I think there's progress in those areas. Because we live in a fallen creation, every time something good happens, there's other things that happen that aren't so good. And so we're this idea that we're always just, one day we're going to get that all perfect. We're never going to get perfect. We're going to make progress in this area, and then we're going to screw up over here with something else, you know, because right. That's always the case.
One of the interesting points that came up in our conversation last week with Dr. Noel was that he also mentioned we have coming onto the scene people like Francis Collins and BioLogos. We talked about Catherine Hayhoe, who's a world-class and evangelical climatologist, basically. So these are new people coming onto the scene. But when you talk about their names, people go, who? Who are you talking about? But if you mention Ken Ham, they go, oh, yeah, right. I know that guy. I know Answers in Genesis.
Yeah.
I think the reason why he and Answers in Genesis have made such an impact, it's because a lot of scholars, you know, biblical scholars, they like the academic stuff. And they like to stay in the academic world and write books and articles to impress each other. They don't want to get into the high school and into the churches and deal with ignorant people and get beat up. You have to do that. I mean, not to pat myself on the back, but that's kind of what I've done. And I've gotten beat up for it. But because of that, I could speak firsthand. Like at the high school level in Christian high school, there isn't good biblical studies curriculum. I've literally, every place I've gone to, I've made up my own because it's not there. You have, even one of my favorite biblical scholars, N.T. Wright, he could try to write for the common masses, but he's such an intellectual, he's still the rungs above. And so there's this big vacuum, I think, in the evangelical world, the lay people and schools and churches. There's not a lot of accessible material for biblical studies. And so along comes Ken Ham with like, A is for, you know, where D is for dinosaur. Oh, this is understandable. And he writes at that level and he fills that vacuum because I think a lot of Christian academics don't want to bother dealing with the dirty little people who don't know anything, you know?
That's a really good point, you know. We've talked about that on this podcast a number of times. How what's going on at the kind of, let's call it the evangelical or even just generally Christian academic level, just does not filter down. You know, it doesn't. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. I know in my own situation, that's kind of been my life's mission in a lot of ways. I've done a lot of teaching in churches to bring to lay people a level of scholarship that they never get. They're not going to pursue it on their own. And try, just like you're saying, try to bridge that gap. And the response generally that I've had to that has been fabulous, except that it, again, like you, it has gotten me into trouble in a number of churches and contexts, you know, because they're not ready for it.
Yeah.
They can't handle that. They're still living in the past. It's kind of also interesting to me. It almost seems like what's happening in the Christian school system where you've been involved in heavily, it's almost a mirror of what happened in the public system with Scopes. You're kind of like a Scopes, except in the Christian school system. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like the public system went through that back in the 20s and they kind of dealt with it. And now it's coming to fruition in the Christian education world. It's just interesting that to me, there seems a parallel there.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I can speak firsthand. Like, I mean, I ended up teaching 16 years in three different evangelical schools. Most of the time when I taught the stuff that I learned from Regent College and Trinity Western, the kids liked it. They understood it. You can present academic information as long as you have the level of a freshman. And if you explain it, like, oh, that makes sense. Oh, okay. They want to learn. And it goes back to that first year or two when I taught it in California, the teaching revelation. Kids want to, I think Christians want to learn this stuff, but there's no one to teach them because they're either academics like to be academic-y, and Ken Ham wants to fight your culture war. And so it's always going to be a need. I personally think every college professor, especially in biblical studies, should be forced to teach in a Christian high school for at least 2 years. I mean, that's the best thing I could have ever done.
That's what a teacher is supposed to be. They're supposed to be the bridge between difficult concepts and relating them and getting them into people's minds. C.S. Lewis, I think, is a great example of that, whether I agree or disagree with him. He was an academic who was really able to talk to regular people, you know,
Well,
and he.
even when I was a junior and I read Mere Christianity for the first time, it was a little difficult, but I understood it because he wrote it at that level. And then later on, when I ended up teaching Mere Christianity at various times in Christian schools, once I became Orthodox, I would reread it. I'm like, oh, he was Anglican, but he was Ortho. I mean, he was incorporating Plato and Aristotle. I didn't even know he was doing that
Right,
because he
right.
was so good at that. But that's what needs to be done more. And it'll never be done perfectly. And I think there's always, church history will tell you, it's always a mess. What you do, use the parable of the sower. As a teacher, you do what
Right.
you can, you sow your seed. A lot of what we do is going to go on deaf ears, but some of it will take root, and
Yep.
that's all you can
Right.
hope for.
What did you do your PhD work in?
And when I was a regent, I just did comprehensive exams. At Trinity Western, I did my master's thesis on the Book of Jonah and the literary reading of that and intertextuality in the Book of Jonah, basically.
Okay.
And then my PhD, I ended up doing it on Isaiah 7:14 within the literary context of Proto-Isaiah.
This is the verse in the Gospel of Matthew that is always revisited at Christmas time. The one that goes, "The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel." And a careful reading of that passage in Isaiah chapters 7 and 8 will raise some very serious questions about whether Matthew correctly applied this prophecy to the birth story of Jesus. We explored this in detail with Dr. Mark Elliott, a world-recognized Bible translator, in episode 116, around the 40-minute mark.
And basically, how the Emmanuel verse fits in that original context of Isaiah 1 through 39.
Okay.
And basically, my argument is when you look at Isaiah 7 through 12, that's all set during the Syro-Ephraimite crisis of roughly 742-ish. And King Ahaz, basically, because he invites Assyria in, and Isaiah says, "You idiot, here's the Emmanuel." That's the context of the Emmanuel verses. And
Okay.
so I argue that in 7 through 12, he's telling Ahaz, because of your lack of faith in Yahweh, you are inviting Assyria in. By the time this kid grows up, Assyria is going to come in and put its boot on your neck, and you're going to be oppressed by Assyria. But through this child who is going to put his faith in Yahweh, he's going to lift the boot of Assyria. And then what you see in Isaiah 36 to 39, Sennacherib's invasion, there are so many literary parallels between those two bookends. You see Hezekiah basically, unlike his father, putting his faith in Yahweh and Yahweh responding. And that prophecy that Isaiah gives in 7 through 12 gets fulfilled in 36 to 39.
Okay.
And therefore, in the original context, Isaiah 7:14 is all about Hezekiah in the 8th century. But then later on, it invites you to, like, what's Matthew doing when he quotes Isaiah 7:14? And I argue that he knows the story. He's trying to make a parallel to say Jesus is like that, but bigger, and there's other theological things. So to understand the original context, oh, then you understand better what Matthew is doing. He's not treating it like Nostradamus. He's doing something, Christ is fulfilling it literally, like it had an original fulfillment, but then Jesus fulfills God's ultimate
Right,
plan.
right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay, gentlemen, we're going to have to draw a line under this work. But
Yeah.
before we do go, then, do you have anything in the pipelines? This book is coming near to the end, and you've got other ones in the pipeline?
Yeah, the second edition of Heresy of Ham, I'm going to be sending to Wittenstock, and hopefully it'll be out, hopefully in the fall. And then I am also talking about my career as a teaching in Christian high schools. I recently got a book published called The Blue Collar Bible Scholar Reader's Guide for the New Testament. A workbook is going to be coming out with that. And that's really a compilation of like all my assignments I made as a Bible teacher for years. And then also, I have an Old Testament Reader's Guide that's done, but that's in the pipeline to get published along with the workbook. And that those two things are like the culmination of my 25 years of biblical studies, teaching high school and college. And then I'll be on to some other stuff.
Yeah, great.
Okay, so Joel, it was great to get your perspective on this issue from both sides of the story. young earth creationism, education, both as the consumer and as the one in the delivery end of that.
Yeah, thank you very much. What a great chat.
All right, no problem. Thanks.
See you later.
Bye for now. You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjansen@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjansen.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.